So we're live.
Some of the things that bother you and don't bother you.
Some of the things. Oh my gosh. Oh, you know what? We were joking that, like, between me and Paul, like, Paul's always like got heart eyes for me. I can almost do no wrong. He thinks I'm, and I'm always joking. I'm like, your like view of me is so amazing because.
Imagine if you had that view of yourself.
Imagine if I had that view of myself. I don't. But we were joking that when Daddy doesn't have with the girls, when he doesn't have heart eyes for me, and it's when I like flash fry his clothes in the dryer, he like loses his mind. When I, or like I waste food or something and I leave something out or burn the chicken, mm-hmm. he can like. It really,
all the blood drains out of his body.
Yes. More like, and like my list for him of those things is like forever long. Mm-hmm. Like the floss in the shower. Like he just collects it. He won't take it out of the shower and put it in the trash can. Nope. He just leaves it in the shower.
I don't know what it is, like the difference between men and women, and you know, it's probably something that is inherent in our DNA about the way that we look at women and the way that men or women look at men, and
oh my God, you know, right?
That sort of thing. There's differences.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah, we were just it was funny to make the list. His list is like three things. Yeah. It's usually when I burn something or like waste something. And mine is forever long.
Yeah. Yeah. All of the things. All of the rest of the things are your list.
Everything else.
Yeah.
But yeah, what else ticks? Not much, like, in terms of, like, my job, when things that are supposed to just be easy and work fail,
mm-hmm.
it unravels me. But if I know something's going to be hard and I've got to figure it out and I'm ready, but if it just... Like my hard drive crashing, which has happened to me a couple times. Has it really?
I've never had that issue with, I've gotten to the point with like computers that they just become like really slow, but I've literally never had a computer crash and like die.
As a photographer and videographer, I deal with so much data and the files, the photos that I take are raw. So they're huge files and there's hundreds of them.
Yeah.
For any given shoot. And then I put that on my hard drive, and it will just sometimes just fail. Or if you knock it wrong and it disconnects.
Is there like a cloud version that you can just get so that it's like always like memory storage and stuff like that has to be cheaper and cheaper now.
Yeah. Right? And I've got as much memory as I can. But like even on my phone, when we record these things, I'll max out. And I've got like 2 terabytes, 5 terabytes. I don't even know. I'm like, whatever is the most is worth it to me. What about you? Like, you've been doing this for so long. Is there anything that still gets under your skin in terms of
like real estate? With my wife? No, nothing ever. Nothing ever bothers me about my wife.
No, with work.
That's a good question. With work these days, I think I become sort of impatient if I'm doing things that sort of don't align with like what I want to be doing at this point in my career. So like if I'm doing something because I have to do it, mm-hmm. but I don't really want to do it, that stuff bothers me. You know, sort of like a lot of the times things that I get frustrated with are of my own doing. Like I'll take on a client where I know the right fit. And
you
I know
that feeling.
Yeah. And I ignore the feeling because I'm just like, well, you know, we've got the systems and it won't be that much of a pain in the butt. And then all of a sudden it becomes a massive, massive pain in the butt. And
yes.
And then, you know, once you start, like, I'm not going to let them go. I signed up for it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that sort of stuff. And it's usually when clients are like, I can deal with emotional clients. It's just when people are very unreasonable and unappreciative. Like, they can be one of two things. They can either be unreasonable or like not appreciate the stuff that we're doing. I can handle one, but when they're both, like, their expectations are so high, they're very unreasonable about what their requests are, either of me or of the other party. A lot of the times it's like the buyer or the seller being unreasonably upset at the buyer. Really? Like, we have a situation going on right now, and I can't go into too much detail, but it's actually my client that's being wildly unreasonable. And then I have to try to relay, you know, like, unreasonableness to, like, and try to craft it so that it's not as unreasonable
as to, you know, it is
to the seller and to the seller's agent and to the attorneys. And, you know, there's only so much that I can reframe sort of unreasonable and, you know, annoying sort of requests.
Do you ever feel like it's a reflection of you? Does that...
I think that I have found a way to skate a pretty thin line on... I think a lot of the reflection comes from lack of communication, and that's not something that I do. So, like, I don't... I also fully understand that I don't have control over my clients, and I don't imply that I do. If my client's being unreasonable, like, listen, that's... This is not my decisions. I am relaying the information and trying to attempt to work with everybody so that we can get the job done, whatever the job
is.
Yeah,
there's
so,
a shield.
So I think people, I personally, I get annoyed with real estate agents, and I take it as a reflection on them if their lack of communication is poor. So, like, they just don't, like, somebody's being unreasonable and then they just don't respond to us. They don't get back to us for days.
Yeah, that's literally their job.
Communication is their job. And so, yes, if they're not doing that appropriately, that's when I sort of take a different view on a real estate agent. The X's and O's about how a client reacts. I do think that there is sort of a lack of professionalism sometime, or just a lack of experience on guiding your clients. So some agents just won't do a very good job explaining the situation.
Like, here's, I know what you're feeling and thinking, but here's why that doesn't necessarily work. Or it might, you might find yourself in a situation.
Properly setting expectations. That's a lot of it. Like, I do a lot of sort of, you know, before we get into the transaction or the listing or the buy process, we do a lot of sort of prepping our clients to know exactly what they can expect and what could go wrong. And if agents aren't doing that, that can be really difficult because then the clients are caught off guard and they don't know how to act.
So would you say that comes with experience, or were you taught that? I mean, to kind of, like, backtrack, today we're going to be talking about how you got here, you got to this seat, even in this office. But I think people know a lot of bits of your story.
Yeah.
And your style and Sandy and all that. And they see you on social media and they know you're in Mansfield now. And they know that they've been to masterminds, heard you on podcasts and things like that, and know parts. But I kind of wanted to go from, like, the very beginning. And it even starts with, I mean, literally your mom. You grew up as a child exposed to this world of real estate.
Yeah. I mean, I had salespeople as parents. So my dad was in sales. He was in radio sales for, you know, my entire childhood. And then my mother got into real estate sort of when I was like, I don't know the exact age, maybe 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there, like late middle school. That's sort of when my mother got into real estate, and she became very, very successful very quickly.
Really?
Yeah. So she went from, you know, from starting in the business to becoming one of the top producing agents in the area, you know, within a couple of years.
What do you think, she just had the skill?
Yeah, I think that she had the drive and the motivation. So, you know, the long story is she got married very early, you know, which was which was great. My parents are still married to this day. Wow. But then she had kids sort of very quickly after that. So she never really got into a career. She had, you know, she had a career before kids, but never really got into it. So I think a lot of her motivation was because she sort of had some pent up demand to do something exciting and, you know, and
we've talked about real estate being amazing avenue because you don't have to have any experience or any capitals to start. You just got to get your license and hit the ground.
Yep.
And she sounds like she did that. Did she discover she was a salesperson?
So she's more of an extrovert than I am. So she's, while she likes to say that she's a driver personality, she's an expressive, you know, my mom, when she's coming, she wears a leopard print clothing and she's got loud glasses and, you know, so she's
confident,
you know, she speaks her mind. So I think she found a lot of value in sort of building relationships and having interactions with clients. She very much wants to help. She's the oldest of 8 children. So she's always had like a maternal instinct to her, you know, raising her younger brothers and sisters and sort of doing that. And so, yeah. And then she sort of connected with a coaching company very early on in her career. And that coaching company was the same one that I started with, you know, all those years later, but it sort of gave her the structure and she doesn't have any problem executing.
Okay.
So, you know, you give her sort of a task and a plan and everything else and she'll just run with it.
She's a firstborn.
Yep.
Yeah. That's typical. So you grew up going to open houses with her, I assume. I mean, we all know the kids of real estate.
Yeah. I never went to an open house because she didn't believe in them because the coaching company didn't believe in open houses.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but it was more like she did business networking on Thursday mornings and it started at like 6 or 6:30. So it was before school. And so my dad would leave for work and, you know, we would go and we would sit in the corner while they did their network meeting first thing in the morning on Thursday mornings.
So you were exposed to that mindset early.
Yeah.
And coaching, did you like listen to tapes in the car?
Well, that's what I think I mentioned that the other day, but like, yeah, that was the conversation she would have. You know, she had magnet sticker on the side of her car that said, you know, had her face on it and the, all of her information on the side. Like, you know, she did everything to try to succeed and, you know, help her clients and build her business. And, you know, she met very early on the broker of her office is still her broker today. So the two of them have been together for, you know, 30 plus years.
I feel like that loyalty, you know, that generation, they are just remarably loyal. Once they find something that works, they just never look back.
Well, it's the value of a relationship too, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, perhaps putting sort of the relationship and the value of that relationship above like a little bit more money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like Paul's grandfather worked for IBM for 30 years. And that just doesn't happen anymore.
Well, but that's also because I think that IBM probably back in the day took care of their employees better than mass corporations do now. But
True. I mean, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think that there's been this shift where sort of, I don't know that large corporations sort of care for their employees like they used to. Mm-hmm. I mean, no more evidence than pensions are non-existent anymore, right? Like you used to put 25, 30 years in and you'd get a pension and it would be substantial. Like you could live the rest of your life off of it. Now it's a 6% contribution to your SEP and or your 401k and that's sort of it. Yeah. But that relationship was really good for her. The coaching relationship was really good for her. And yeah, I mean, it exposed me at a very early age. And that's why one of her big goals when we were kids was that she wanted to, you know, be able to pay for our college education. And so at one point, she had my older sister in Northeastern. I was at Bryan College. And my younger sister was at RIT up in New York. So at one point she was paying full board for, you know, 3 colleges. And, you know, she'll tell you to this day that she's never done more real estate transactions in a year than those couple of years where she had to, right? So there was a necessity to make a lot of money. And, you know, she put her head down and went to work.
She had such a clear vision of why.
Correct.
I'm sure it was really hard, but she knew why she was doing it. She had like almost like tangible reasons. I mean, she did. She had her kids.
Yep.
And then at college, she could actually see what she was working on.
Yeah.
And funding.
Yep.
So I'm sure that was super motivating. So you mentioned you went to Bryan College.
Yep.
Did you go to college thinking I'm going to be a realtor?
No, never. Well, I knew that they're sort of, so what I was exposed to was that, you know, that you could create outsized outcomes, you know, based on your work ethic in this space. But I knew that of sales in general.
Okay.
So I knew that, you know, with my dad in sales and my mother in sales, and it was different because, you know, my dad did like corporate sort of sponsor, like advertising sales. So it was a little bit different.
For radio.
Yeah, for radio. And then, but my mother, you know, it was very interesting because I got the exposure, but I also sort of very much understood like the commitment, the level of commitment. And it was hard for me at that point in my life to sort of voluntarily go into a business that I knew would sort of wholly consume you as an individual. One of the nice things was the, you know, during college, I think when I turned 18, so I think it was maybe my sophomore or my junior year. I can't even remember now. I think it was sophomore year. I was 18 years old. I used to travel back to Connecticut during the week to go to real estate school at or around UConn. So it was like an hour and 15 minute drive. And I'd go at nights while I was at college back to Connecticut on like Tuesday or Thursday. And it would be a 2 or 3 hour course. And I would go, and I think we did that for, you know, 2 months or 3 months or something like that.
To get your license?
To get my real estate license.
And were you just looking to be able to get extra money?
Well, I looked at it as a job. So my mother sold me on the idea, which was accurate, that I could come in and prospect the business because she was doing a lot of business at that point and she didn't really have a buyer's agent. So she said, come in and I will give you a 50-50 split on commissions. You work with buyers. I'll give you some, but you can go out. And this was the day, and for those folks who, you know, either are in real estate for a long time or remember selling property back in the day, you know, one of the things that real estate agents used to do is they'd put in, because there was no like on-demand, you know, internet in your pocket. What they would do is at the bottom of the sign, they'd put an 800 number, an 888 number with a code. So it was like a 4-digit or 3-digit code, and you would call this number and you'd punch in the code, and then it would give you a pre-recorded information about the house. So if you're driving by a house on 123 Main Street, call this number, plug in that, call the 800 number, plug in the code, and then you could hear about the house, how much it was worth, all that kind of stuff. So she used to do that. But what would happen is that would also capture the person's information, the telephone number, all that kind of stuff. And then it would send a message to a beeper, right? A pager back in the day.
Yeah.
And the pager would come up with the person's only the person's telephone number and the code for that particular property. So I used to drive around, like back in the day, I used to have a folder and it used to have the code of the house that my mom was listing. And this was back in the day when it would take 3 to 6 months to sell a house. So she would have 18 to 20 houses on the market. So, you know, I had a 3-ring binder that we would put information on each house about. And so I would call the number that had just called and I'd say, hi, this is Ben Esposito. At the time she was working for Remax. This is Ben Esposito over at Remax. I saw that you just called on 123 Main Street. I understand that it gave you some pre-recorded information about the home, but I wanted to follow up and see if you had any questions on it.
So you did that for her?
Yeah, 18 years old. And I think that first summer that I worked for her in like 2.5 months, I made like 13 grand. So then I went, so summer job.
And you got really used to.
No, this is back in like 2000. So 13 grand for 2.5 months of work is like crazy money.
And you got used to talking to people on the phone you didn't know, adults. Like at 18, I feel like kids today still have trouble talking to adults. Some.
Yeah, I mean, I was terrified of it.
You were?
Yeah, I used to sweat through it and, you know, probably fairly terrible at it. I mean, I know that I was also really good at making connections with people. You know, my mom's clients, I was able to come in and, you know, just have conversations with them and that sort of thing. I think that, you know, the idea that I was 18 years old and I probably have a fonder memory of the experience.
Looking back
and probably I didn't do, if I created one or two pieces of business from the entire summer of calling those people, that's probably accurate. My mother would have people that were looking at houses far away and I would print out MapQuest directions. That's how you got around. And, you know, I remember putting client like a mid 50-year-old guy in my, you know, in my 1996 Acura Integra. Actually, at the time, I think it was like a 93 red Acura Integra. And
you went
and drive them around, show them houses.
Do you, I mean, with the beeper and the code and MapQuest, and it was harder, but was it simpler? Was it easier than now with all the clicks and the buttons and the QR codes and the how many can you see in one day? And
yeah, I think.
I think back on it, sounds calm to me.
Yeah, but I think it probably, I think every sort of iteration of real estate has their own challenges. I think it was just different challenges back then.
That's wild. You've seen that much of a spectrum.
Yeah.
From beepers and codes and MapQuest.
Well, when my mother first started, and, you know, this was like pre-internet. So you used to get a three-ring binder, or I don't know how it was prepared, but, you know, they would get one listing update per week and you would get this delivered to the office and you would flip through the houses. So if you wanted to get your house on the market, you get it on the market by a deadline because then it would be included in the next cycle of books. And that's when, you know, brokers used to do broker tours because, you know, you'd get one picture maybe of a listing and then you get all the information about the listing. But, you know, a buyer call and say, hey, what do you have available for a 3-bedroom in these towns? You have to flip through the book.
Wow.
And identify the ones that are available. And then, you know, if you knew stuff about those houses, like if you had been in those houses, you could give them that much more information about it.
Okay.
But you used to have to drive, like you want town hall information. Right now, we just go online. So one of the first jobs that I had for her, like that summer that I first started working, I would have to drive to the town hall. I'd have to go to the building department. I'd have to pull the property card. I'd have to pay 5 cents for a copy of the plot map. And then I'd have to go to the registry of deeds and look up the deed information to make sure that the owner of the house that we're selling is actually the owner that we're working with. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to go and spend 2 hours collecting information that now we just pull up in half a second online. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things that I had to do all the time.
So you spent your summers doing that for your mom while you were in college, got your license, and then you went to work? Or did you go straight into real estate after college?
I worked two summers. I think it was 2 summers because it was summer between sophomore and junior and the summer between junior and senior. And then when I graduated college, I think I went back for the summer and then I got an apartment in Providence with my friends.
Okay.
And I sort of at that point realized that, you know, I didn't really want to sell real estate like my mother did, you know, and part of it is, you know, and I think she's gotten sensitive to it over the years. We've had conversations about it, but, you know, I left and the conversation that I had with myself was that she works entirely too hard and I just don't want that. Mm-hmm. You know, when you do real estate at this volume, I saw it firsthand that, you know, we'd be on vacation and she'd be on calls, you know, she'd be working on weekends and she'd have to run out at nights and we worked with it and it was great for our family. But I also just sort of, I didn't see the connection between sort of the ability to make money on demand and, you know, create these amazing things. I didn't connect those dots at that point. Okay. So I think, you know, I left after college. I got a job roofing houses because I used to roof houses in the, with my uncle. And so I got a job just to pay some bills, roofing houses. And then I found a job after a couple of months working at Wells Fargo Financial as an account manager. And I would make sales calls to people who like financed like couches at 0%, you know, we would call them and offer a refinance for them. And so when I was living in Providence, calling people, sales. And then I did that for like 2 years and then they promoted me from maybe even after like 18 months, I was there 18 months and they gave me, there was a branch manager that left that was down in Hyannis. And so the regional manager asked me to cover that for a certain period of time until they could fill the position. So I used to go down there. I'd drive down there once or twice a week and I'd stay in a hotel a couple of nights. And I was managing that office of salespeople when I was probably 24, 25 years old. And then they found a permanent manager for that. I went back to the East Providence location, and then they offered me a Dedham, a branch manager position in Dedham. So I took that when I was 25, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. And I did that for about a year. So I was managing the account managers, which was...
At 25?
At 25.
How'd that go?
I mean, I don't know. Not well. I mean, I think like we made numbers and everything like that, but I was a terrible... I didn't understand managing people or leading people.
I mean, you were barely a 25 year old male. Like, you're just figuring out who you are.
You know,
you're on your own path.
Like, drinking on the weekends and during the week, and I'd go out with my salespeople and drink with them, and you know, just like a typical 25 year old. I wasn't sort of like any special sort of situation.
Wisdom.
And there wasn't like branch managers. Like, they promote from within because they can get me cheaper than going out and getting an actual, you know, manager of people. And so, you know, there wasn't anything particularly sort of unique about what we were doing. It was just sort of plug and play people into positions.
Yeah.
And I realized at the time that I felt like I was more suited for sales. I always looked at myself as an incredibly good, like, assistant manager. Because I could lead by example, and that was sort of where I created that belief that I wasn't really a good leader. I could lead by example, but I couldn't stop what I was doing and get other people to be responsible for the results. I was good at being the person that was responsible for the results, but I wasn't good at leading other people who were responsible for the results. Like, so if I wasn't doing it personally, then like I was sort of lost. I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
That makes sense too. And I feel like that just comes with time because you see more scenarios, and even just becoming like a parent helps you realize that there's different personalities and there's different ways to motivate people and to get people to act a certain way.
And so perhaps with exposure, like if I was, I had a great branch manager down in East Providence, and you know, the regional manager was good, but you know, it was like a reverse funnel to, you know, the regional manager was a branch manager for a very long time that started as account manager that, you know, so it's just like you sort of move up the ladder.
And you didn't feel like energized or sparked by it. You just kind of...
No, not managing. Like, all I wanted to do was sell. Like, I looked at people that were selling, and I couldn't understand why they had a hard time with it. But I didn't know any better on how to coach or lead them.
Oh,
outside of just like stepping in and doing it myself.
So is that when you realized you had a unique capability to sell?
I don't know that I looked at it that way, that I had a unique capability, I think. But that was when I made the decision that sales was more in alignment than just moving up this sort of reverse funnel at a corporation like that.
It was just easier for you to just get the job done.
Yeah.
And, yourself.
And that's when I sat back and I said, all right, well, if I am going to sell, right, then... Because the reason that I got the job at Wells Fargo in the first place was because there was a salary. Like, it was a salaried position. And I don't even think that there wasn't even any bonuses, like, based on sales production. So I was able to just make a salary, and that was great because I was partying with my friends and living in East Providence, on the east side of Providence. And, you know, we had an apartment and we partied all the time, and it was like an extension of college. And I just wanted a paycheck. I wanted to pay for my car and my lifestyle and my house. I had no other desires or hopes or dreams at that point. I just wanted to kind of hang out and do what I was doing. And then, you know, when I figured out that going up this ladder and making more salary, right, because I got a salary bump when I was the, you know, the branch manager, and there was some incentives and stuff like that and some bonus stuff. But, you know, I got to the point where if I'm not going to stay in management and I'm going to go back to sales, like, why go back to being an account manager at Wells Fargo and making 50 grand a year? Why not just go sell real estate? I know I can do that and make more money. Yeah.
And you know the money.
Yep.
If you're good at sales and you kind of like working on your own, might as well go sell the most expensive asset you can.
Yeah.
So you left Wells Fargo, left the brand, the managing world behind.
Yep.
And you were licensed in Connecticut, and then but you're living in Massachusetts, so you got your license here.
So I wasn't licensed anymore. I let that license go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You let
so
it
I didn't renew. Yeah, I didn't renew that license.
So you had to sit for the exam again
in here. Massachusetts. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And then what happened? Just hit the ground running.
Well, it's funny to look back at sort of like what the risks that you take sort of in your youth, and you look back on it and you look at it as such like an enormous risk. But you know, at the time, it didn't seem like I was in debt, because you know, part of the good and bad of it is that I made a lot of money in the summers, but then I got used to spending money.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, when I got into real estate, I had some credit card debt, and you know, I had got car loans and all that kind of stuff. And I just sort of realized, you know, that I just kind of was like, all right, I'm going to get back into real estate. And then I made the decision. I didn't think much more about it. Like, I didn't have a huge plan. You know, my living expenses were relatively minor, so it wasn't, you know, a huge risk, but still had to make payments and all that kind of stuff. And I think at the time, like at the peak, I had close to like $50,000 in credit card debt as a, wow, like a mid 20-year-old person. Right.
Wow.
And so
you were forming some habits.
Yeah. Even back then, I was spending money to reward yourself and sort of trying to live the lifestyle that I had sort of seen as what I wanted. Right. So I spent way more than I should have, and I didn't save and that sort of thing. So, you know, then I got into real estate, and I just had assumed that I could put in the effort that I always have and then have it turn into, you know, results. So I got into real estate in 2006. And as most, you know, folks that know back in that timeline, you know, the housing crash happened in, you know, 07, 08. So I got into real estate. I got a coach at that point. And I think...
And did you get a coach because you had always seen your mom have a coach?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So she would, you know, I would go down to, there was three events per year that Mike Ferry would host, and one was in Orlando, one was out in California, one was in Vegas. And I would, you know, fly a cheap flight there, and I'd, you know, sleep on the couch in my mom's, you know, hotel room that she got, so I could go to the event, and she would pay for me to go to the event. And so she got me exposed to that sort of thing. And then, you know, when I was there, I would meet other, you know, early or mid 20-year-old guys and gals, and, you know, then get motivated that they've been in the business a year or two and they're making 100 grand or, you know, 200 grand or whatever it might be. And so I got really motivated. And so I signed up for coaching, and I think the first full year, so I got in when I was 26 years old, but I started in April or May or something like that. And then my first full year in real estate, I think, you know, to the team that I was on, because I joined a team as well, I think I brought in like 70 grand in that first year, which was good, mm-hmm. You know, especially back in, you know, this would have been 2006, 2007.
That's a lot of money.
Started the following year, and that's when the market started to crash and everything became that much more difficult. Like, the number of sales was down exponentially. I didn't have any book of business in the area, anything like that.
That had to be sobering. Like, oh... Like,
I don't know that I was sober for any of it, but yeah.
But like, oh, shit happens. Like, this isn't as like easy, like I'll figure it out. Like, it, real life, the crash, struggling to get work, having bills, debt start to build. I mean, the pressure started to kind of like condense or whatever.
Yeah. And what's interesting about maybe about my personality, or... You know, I was never very in touch with my emotions. You know, even now I have to work really hard to sort of be introspective and see what I feel about things. Like, I have to try really hard. That's not a natural thing for me. So even at the time, like, yeah, it was stressful, but I was like, all right, well, I'll just pivot and go and do this. And so I was always looking. I was always the type of person that was looking for opportunities. Like, I was always like, all right, well, how can I solve this problem? Like, if nothing else, I'm a problem solver.
Okay.
Right. So
we've talked about your love for puzzles.
Yeah.
You love to figure it out. It's just a task.
It's just something that needs to get worked out. And that was more because there was, you know, and I look at it now and I realize, you know, part of the reason that I didn't have anxiety and stress and that sort of thing is because the repercussions of not making it were so small. Like, okay. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a mortgage at the time. Like, my living expenses, I think I was paying like $750 in rent for a studio apartment.
Were you working a lot then? Or did your years of working 60 to 70 hours, never having time off, I mean, just absolutely grinding at work, was that
wife
and kids? When the pressure, when you started to have real pressures?
I think that I developed a really, really good work ethic. Well, I think I've always had a really strong work ethic. I think distractions were my biggest issue.
Okay.
You know, whether that be social or be, you know, whatever, mid-20-year-old guys
just
are
getting in your
sort
own
of
way.
Yeah, getting in your own way, right? But no, I think I developed a really strong work ethic when I sort of pivoted from that conventional real estate in 2007. There was a couple of guys who are partnered with me here at eXp now, Rob and Scott O'Donnell, and at the time they were doing a ton of bank owned and foreclosed property work. And so what that really looked like is they started to go to all of these nationwide banks or financial institutions, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Sovereign Bank, Citizens, all of those kind of things. And they would say, hey, listen, I know that the foreclosures are happening a lot right now if you need help with those foreclosures. And so they used to go to the auctions. And if the bank bought it back at auction, they would do a market analysis and they would mail that market analysis to the bank. And then they would call the bank until that market analysis got in front of the decision maker for who decides who's going to help sell that property. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm a bank and I foreclose on a property, you're not local to that property. You need somebody to help do the eviction. So you need an attorney. You need somebody to clean out the property. You need somebody to sell the property. And so you need an attorney and you need a real estate agent. And you don't want to manage that whole process. So you hire the real estate agent who can manage that process for you. They're going to get the commission. And because of that, they're going to do all the rest of the crap. And so they did an amazing job setting up that infrastructure to go after. And I think at their peak, you know, they were selling 300, 350 bank-owned properties per year.
Wow. Wow.
But along with that, there's a lot of work that needs to get done.
That's a ton of transactions.
It is. So that's more like property management than anything else. Like the sale of the real estate at the end of the day was a foregone conclusion. You put it on at a price, and if it doesn't sell, you just reduce the price over time and somebody ends up buying it.
So it was less emotional.
There was no emotions outside of like what I did, which was long story medium, I guess. I went to them just hat in hand and I said, hey, listen, you know, I'm having trouble sort of like making ends meet. Is there anything that I can do for you just on the side? Do you need me to like go out and check on properties, all this kind of stuff? So they said, yeah, well, we're happy to have you start working hourly for us. And so I just started like doing odd jobs for them. You know, if they needed to go and inspect a property, I would go and take a look at it and report back and take some photos with a Canon SureShot thing.
And is this while you're also doing your own list and sale?
Yeah. So I was still trying to, you know, have that conventional sales business.
Okay. At Remax?
At Remax. So no. Rob and Scott worked at Remax and they were selling the foreclosures under Remax.
Okay.
But it was a relationship that they created. So they formed a team that was called the Asset Management Division. It was Rob, Scott, and another guy named Alan Yanofsky. And the three of them worked together to sell all of these properties.
And you just said, I would like some extra work, more hours. You consistently were not afraid of the hours. If it was going to give you results.
Well, and then there was a definitive like return on investment. I started to see opportunities. So like they would pay me hourly to sell their properties. I would also have first chance with like investors that were interested in buying the property. So I started working with a lot of investors.
So you started to get a client, like a connection client list.
And it was three or four or five of these investors that would sell multiple properties per year. So I would establish a relationship and I would call. So we had a good new property. I would call my list of investors. One of them would be interested. I would get the, you know, the buy side mm-hmm. of that sale, and then they'd renovate it and I'd get the sell side of that transaction. So I was doing like, while I was working for them, I was selling, you know, between 12, 18 houses a year with investors. And then maybe a couple, a handful of like my friends would buy or sell, or I would get a buyer from somewhere else, or, you know, I was still doing some conventional business. I like that
you were getting exposed to all sorts of scenarios too, with investments, with foreclosure, with person to person. You know, I say that like a classic family buying a home and the family selling. So you were just seeing all these different puzzle pieces.
Yeah. And I think that's where I started to correlate, because there was opportunities all over the place. So the bank, when they would send us as real estate agents out to the property, if it was vacant, they would have us call a handyman to install new locks. So just change the lock out. Well, they'd pay a handyman $150. Now, Rob and Scott were paying me to go out and check on the property. And while I was there, I said, I can change locks. So I would get paid to go out to the property, potentially get it for my investor. And then I would change the lock and charge the bank $150. And then the banks needed smoke detectors installed by handyman as well. And I said, well, I have to go out and sit at the smoke inspection with the fire department. So why don't I just replace the smoke detectors, and then I can charge the banks for that. So there was like all of these different things. And it was, you know, that's where there was a lot of money right there. And there was a lot of different little avenues. And so
did you start to build real income, lower your debt, and like feel like this was, how old were you? 20, 30, almost 30 at this point?
Yeah, it was right in that timeline. So 2008, 2009, 2010, that's when I met Colleen. So like everything. So at that point I started to like not want any debt. So I still have like this payment tracker and Excel spreadsheet that showed like, so every time I would get a commission, like I would just like, I'd put $5,000 towards the credit card debt, and it took me, I don't know, like 18 months, but then
self-discipline.
Then I paid all of the debt off and I was like completely debt free by, you know, within 2 years.
And did you think like never again?
Yeah, I think that gave me a lot of fear of debt for sure. I think it
can be suffocating, and like the more you try to dig out, the deeper the hole can sometimes get.
Yeah, and I think for me, I've never been particularly worried about making the money to be able to pay the bills, but I think I started to recognize that the mental sort of strain that would happen with having that amount of debt wasn't worth the benefit of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that I haven't, you know, gone into significant debt for particular reasons, but that's usually a calculated thing, right?
Yes.
That's intentional.
Yes.
Versus just sort of letting it spiral out of control. I haven't had a credit card balance like that I haven't paid off since then.
And so you met Colleen, got married, you're working for Rob and Scott?
So yeah, so I'm a real estate agent on their team. So like just like Esposito Realty Group, that was what the asset management division was.
But you were under them.
Yep.
In their office.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the girls and you're just like working a ton.
Yeah. So I'm working a lot of hours. It's a good life. I mean, the beauty of that particular part of real estate was that it wasn't nights and weekends. It was like during the week. And I could work weekends if I was selling a property for one of my investors. I would do the open houses or, you know, work with buyers if I was showing friends or family or anything like that. But like, it wasn't overly taxing. Like I could, like in the summers, I would go away every weekend to hang out with my buddies up at their lake houses or go to, you know, the Cape. Or, you know, when I met Colleen, we would travel all the time. I would go out for a week in Colorado and ski. And
I mean, this sounds great.
It was awesome.
But you...
I was making multiple six figures. So I was, you know, hovering around $200,000 in income those years.
So what made you, I know you switched from Remax to Compass in 2021. It was a couple of years after your second daughter was born. Like you're in a groove. You know what you're going to, like, you well, know so you can
yeah,
make
there's
income.
There's a long period of time because when in 2013, I started to see like, the banks got a lot tighter on everything. They
okay.
required a lot more services and they started dropping their commissions. So they were looking at, instead of making the ease of it, they wanted to maximize profitability. And so they would cut our commissions and they would start making, you know, us as real estate agents start doing even more. So like one of the things that they did was, and we were at the time, we would manage like 200 properties at a time. So okay. we'd have like 50 of them that are in pre-foreclosure or in the eviction status. You know, we'd have 30 or 40 that were getting ready for market. We would have 30 or 40 that were on market, and then 30 or 40 that were under contract. Like, so like hundreds of properties every month. And I think what they started to do was they said, all right, well, we want you guys to keep a better eye on these properties. So every week we want you to go out to the property and take a picture of every single room, and we want it, you know, stamped, like date stamped.
The banks.
So we would have 200 properties that we would need to go out every week and take pictures of.
Is this still to this day a practice?
I don't have any idea whether that's still a thing or not, but okay. So profitability started to go down, and we also okay. noticed that, you know, we were sort of coming out of that housing crisis, and
yes.
and, you know, the bank owned properties were starting to dry up or at least become, you know, not as prominent within the industry.
Right.
And, you know, Colleen and I got pregnant in 2013, and, you know, Belle was due in July of 14. And I sort of like, she had a really good job. She was up in Boston, you know, but she was in an advertising and PR company. And so it was, you know, she worked long hours too, and she would commute into the city every day. And, you know, her and I had sort of had discussions about, you know, whether or not she'd go back to work or whether she'd just raise the kids. And again, I look back on it and I don't like remember a lot of evaluation of like, I'm going to sit down and, you know, figure all this stuff
with
out.
All
I'm
the
sure.
Numbers,
like, yeah. Like I'm sure that there was like, but it just seemed like at the time, it seemed like a natural transition to go from bank owned. I was selling like, you know, 18 houses for investors, but I knew I could sell. So why not just go back to conventional real estate? If this avenue looks like it's slowing down and dying.
It was. Yes.
This avenue is the next natural thing for me to go to. And so that's when, you know, beginning in 13, I had conversations with, you know, with Rob and Scott and Al, and told them that I was going to sort of transition away from doing the bank owned stuff and helping them. And I was going to go into more conventional sales. And so I hired the wonderful Kathy Anderson, who was my coach for 5 years. I hired her in 2014, in January of 2014. And so I just dedicated like all of my time at that point. I was so used to working like crazy.
Okay.
That working like crazy hours wasn't very difficult for me at that point. And I had a very definitive reason. I wanted to, you know, make sure that we had the ability to have Colleen stay at home with Belle at the time. And, you know, we went through, she went on maternity leave and we didn't really know what she was going to end up doing. But very quickly after that, we determined that she wasn't going to go back to work. And so, you know, we lost health insurance and we lost her salary. And then I made that transition and pivot from the bank owned to just conventional real estate.
You're working a Remax. You're working a ton because now you're single income household. And you've got real responsibilities. You've got daughters, but you know, you can make money doing what you do.
Yep.
And you know your colleagues, and you know Remax, you know the market, you know the area, and then all of a sudden, you made a jump, in October from Compass to Remax. And you were working a lot. What happened?
Well, so tell me about I that. Well, yeah. So I spent
you did like a right turn.
Right. So well, I went from like helping investors and contractors at, you know, with foreclosures being the vast majority of my business. Then I started doing conventional real estate, and I went 2013. I had 18 sort of sales that were associated with me, you know, transactions, and then I went from 18 to 42 to 56. So I went very quickly from
you more than doubled in 3 years.
Yeah, and so way you know, more. 2015, I did 56 transactions, and that was the year that Colleen got pregnant with Rosie.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did 62 transactions the following year. And that was just, I was full in on coaching. I would go to every event every year. I would get coached once a week from Kathy. And it was just, you know, it was very, at that point, it seemed very easy. I would prospect for 4 hours a day. I would, you know, practice and role play and then present. And then I ran the business. I never did open houses back in the day because my coach told me that they weren't worthwhile. Okay. So I would just list property and sell it. And I'd go after, you know, expired listings, and I'd go after for sale by owners, and I'd call around neighborhoods similar to what Pedro's doing right now. And, you know, I just sort of built up the business, and I was diligent and I was laser focused, and, you know, they just practiced repetitious boredom, and I was pretty good at it. I knew that there was what was good for my analytical brain was that it was predictable and duplicatable. So you do these tasks and I don't care how good you are, you'll get results. Now, if you're good at it, if you do the quantity of calls that you're supposed to, but you have an increased quantity, quality of what you're saying, then that maximizes your time. But even if you're like terrible at cold calling, if you make a certain amount of calls, you're going to eventually find somebody who's going to do business with you. So I knew that that was predictable and duplicatable based on what I was doing. And so I just continued to do that over and over and over again. And then, you know, I got to the point where we started to build up the team, and I had assistants, and, you know, my sister started working for me. I had hired another assistant, Chrissy Toronto, who works up at William Ravis and in Canton now, and who I still talk to this day. And, you know, I had a couple of assistants over the years, and then obviously Sandy jumped in the picture a few years later. And then we were sort of sitting around, and that was, you know, I've told the story a lot about how sort of, I was just looking for something different. I had accomplished everything I wanted to. I was making a lot of money, but it, like, there was no, I sort of expected to feel different, you know, getting to this point. It was always like, I was always, you know, running for something. Yeah. Like, I want to accomplish this. I want to get to the top of the hill. I want to, like, obtain this goal. And then once I attain that goal, I'll be sort of centered and at peace and everything will make sense.
And it just wasn't the case.
There's no fanfare. Like, I think that people have this certain expectation when they hit a goal that, you know, balloons are going to fly out from the core of the earth, and, you know, the sky's going to go open up, and some divine is going to tap you on the head and make you happy. And it's just, it's almost anticlimactic, like when you, especially in real estate sales.
Yep.
And so I was just sort of lost. And, you know, my real estate coach, Kathy, was with me for 5 years until 2020. And in 2020, I got another real estate coach through the organization, one of the top coaches there. But he was much more of an alpha male coach. And I think that that works for a lot of people. It didn't really for me, you know, go out and hunt and, you know, bring home the, you know, the spoils and mm-hmm. like, this is your job and all that kind of stuff. And that just, it didn't really align with like how I approached life or work. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of off-putting. And so I did that for a year with him, but that was when I made a lot of money, but I was wildly uncomfortable. And
okay.
So that's when I was introduced to Aaron, and I started coaching with Aaron at the beginning of 2021.
And then in 2021, so you were making record numbers. Mm-hmm. You met Aaron.
Yep.
Hired him as a coach.
Yep.
In 2021. And then you said, I've got, like, it's just not, I'm really successful, but something's not fit, like fitting, clicking, and maybe it's Compass. And is that why you made the switch?
I think I needed a change. I was with Remax since from 2006 to, you know, 2021. Mm-hmm. And so I was there a very long time, and I really liked my broker, and I never really considered or thought about switching. But again, you know, as I was sort of searching for meaning and like some sort of, I don't know that it was a sign a different feeling. Like, I thought I could change. I thought a change of environment would sort of change how I felt.
Yeah.
And it started as I wanted my own office. Some of the guys that, you know, I admired through the coaching organization had their own physical office space. And yeah. So I wanted to create my own physical office space. And I was working in Foxborough, but my main market was Mansfield. And so there was no, you know, real estate office for that I wanted to join here in Mansfield. So I wanted to open up my own thing. And my broker, to his credit, like, he was willing to work with me on it, but he also wanted sort of a commitment for me to stay longer term if he started to do that with me.
And you just knew.
And at the same time, I got introduced to Compass, and it was sort of this different thing. It was a, like a luxury feel and a brand. And, yeah. And I thought, all right, well, if I, like, I want to bring a luxury real estate experience to the Mansfield market. And, you know, they sort of correctly played on all of what all of my ego, you know, by they came in and treated me like I wanted to be treated, right? Like they,
you felt like you deserved.
I felt like I deserved it. And then they threw a lot of money around and, you know, it sort of connected and I got hooked. And so I made that transition.
With Sandy, and you moved to this office at the same time?
No. So that was also during like COVID crazy time. So I transitioned when nobody was really in the office. We were just starting to get back to the office, you know, at the...
Oh, in 2021.
In 2021, we started getting back to routine office visits and all that kind of stuff. But like masks were still a big thing and, you know, all that stuff. So they had an office in Wellesley. So we worked out of my house for a long time looking for office space. And, you know, that's another long story. We found some great office space and I had it designed and we were going to do a huge renovation. And then, you know, the cost of renovation was probably twice as much as I had anticipated. So we, you know, bailed on that and we went to another office space that was, you know, sort of didn't need major renovation, but I started to paint it. I put in carpeting, you know, because it was run down. And while I was in the middle of that, so I'd already leased it, I'd started renovating it, and then this office became available. And so I don't know, like searching for this office probably cost me like 25 grand.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So like, you know, between but engineering and all that kind of stuff. Lost
this rent. Is what you were looking for because you were so run down with not feeling inspired. Like you were making all your numbers, you were hitting all your goals, but nothing felt good. So you thought, okay, like if I just make a beautiful space to go to work every day, maybe that'll feel good. And it made sense.
Yeah, I think it accomplished what I was looking to do, which was become the name in real estate in Mansfield.
It's in the corner on the main street,
right?
Literally,
there's no and when this office was built, I think it was 2013 or so. Another real estate office was in this space, and I looked at it, you know, when it was being built, and that was about when I was transitioning into conventional real estate back from foreclosures, and I was like, you know, egotistically, I was like, that's going to be my office.
You manifested it.
Yeah, I think I backed into it. I don't know that I manifested anything, but, okay. You know, then it was available and it was here. And then, you know, we had a designer come in and design the office. And
this all, so in January of 2021 is also the year, the first year you hit $1 million in rev, right?
Yes. Yep.
So you, in 2021, met Aaron.
Yep.
Switched to Compass.
Yep.
And had a record year.
Yeah.
And when did you move into this office?
It was 2022. Yeah. Probably okay. May of 2022.
But you had it like in plan.
I didn't know about this office when I moved to Compass.
But okay. So you met Aaron, switched to Compass, all the flashy things, luxury level. This was the right fit. Record year. And then you felt nothing still, right?
Yeah, I think
I've heard
that
you say that.
I don't know that I felt nothing. I think I felt accomplished. I felt like I could create what I wanted to. I was just very, very confused about what I wanted out of life. And I had this existing business that most real estate agents and or most people in general, if they looked at what I was doing and what I was making and the lifestyle that I had, it would have been very easy for most people to say, I'll take that, right? Like I'll be that person. I'll work that hard for that amount of money and have this lifestyle and have two kids and this big house. And I was driving a Range Rover at the time. And like, you know, from the outside, it looked so for me to sort of consciously at that point, like not, it was a very conflicting time because I was also like, how could I not be happy if I've accomplished everything that I'm looking to do? I have, you know, the number one office in Mansfield. I have my own place. I'm at this luxury real estate brand. I have a great coach and a great family and I'm making a ton of money.
You're like, living how
could I not be happy? Yet I just wasn't. And I again, going back to the idea that I'm just not super introspective, I can work for years in a row without sort of picking my head up and going, is this the right thing or not? Now I've gotten exponentially better at that.
And you credit that to
Aaron.
To Aaron.
Yeah. In no uncertain terms. So yeah, I mean, again, like it wasn't, But I didn't know what to do. And the only thought I had was to just sort of blow everything up and try to walk away and figure something else out. And so like Colleen and I had very realistic conversations about what that looked like.
I was going to say, like, can you imagine? And then I'm thinking he literally did imagine it. Mm-hmm. Like you had played it out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I used to love watching those, and this is not surprising considering everything, but I used to love watching those like Alaska shows where the guys would live in cabins, like in very remote places. And that
I wonder if there's a study or there's a correlation to when people like peak watching those shows and how much they want it.
That change.
They change yeah. in their life. Mm-hmm. And they're like, maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Because
it was so drastically different.
I've gone through like a phase in my life where I was like watching alone all the time. Mm-hmm. I probably was not very happy.
I think that life forces you at certain points, if you're ignoring it, if you're ignoring what you feel, I think life sort of puts things in front of you in an effort to make you look within to figure out what you actually want out of life.
So you had a record year, 2021.
Yep.
And then you move here in 2022.
Yep.
May?
Yep.
You said?
Yeah, I think we moved in right about then.
All the pieces are falling together in the puzzle as you thought. And you're still just not feeling fulfilled, and you know there's something more. You keep being coached by Aaron, and you realize he's working just as hard as me, but there's something different.
Yeah. So I think at the time to really understand it too is that in 2021, going into 2022 is also when the interest rates had changed. So we went from historically low interest rates where everybody had a 2.5% to 3.5% interest rate to all of a sudden in 2020, I think it was 2022, where interest rates went up to like 5.5%, 6%.
Was that when it happened?
Yeah. So it was like literally I got into this office. Kristen joined me. Emily and Sandy were working here. And that was the team. And then the transaction recession happened where... Wow. It just all of a sudden everybody stopped moving because they didn't want to trade in their low interest rate. And so it was, following my best year in real estate, the next year was 30% less. And mm-hmm. I had all these huge expenses. I was at Compass and they gave me, really nice incentives to go there. But then I had to give them a percentage of my income, which was far greater than what I had at Remax. And so I was making less money per transaction.
Oh my
there was
goodness.
Less business that was going on out there. I think the next year, I'll have to go back and
expense.
Yeah, I have to go back and look at it. But I think I went from like $1 million in GCI to like just under 700, like in 1 year
with more expenses.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so again, then it was like, all right, well, I had to concentrate on getting business and doing business and all that kind of stuff, and then Aaron. After I had joined with EXP, because at the time Aaron was still selling real estate and he was working at Keller Williams. He had a market share ownership, a percentage market share ownership of a Keller Williams office. And he had always talked about leverage, and he was looking at like ways that we could diversify our income portfolio to capitalize on all the business that we do. And part of that is, like title work in other states or like auxiliary products that we can capitalize on the customers and the business that we're already doing. And one of the things that he evaluated at one point, thanks to Jose Morales, who's, one of my upline sponsors, who's an incredibly intelligent person, he finally sort of got Aaron to sit down and look at EXP. And as soon as Aaron looked and saw like legitimately what EXP could do, mm-hmm. he made the decision very quickly to sell his portion. He lost a lot of money selling his equity position in the Keller Williams office, partnered at EXP. And I think that was in mid-2022. And then I think at the beginning of 2023, he was selling, at the time, he was selling over 100 homes a year, and he just stopped selling real estate.
Oh,
and he did
goodness.
Full-time, like, coaching and training and agent attraction at EXP. And so the person that has the most amount of influence on me, who I just I have a level of respect that's hard to like describe for him. He makes these moves and he starts just illustrating in real time. He's a couple of steps ahead. He was selling more real estate than I did, but he's taking huge risk. He drops over $1 million in earned income from selling real estate and just says, you know what, I'm going to let that go because I think that this opportunity is better than this opportunity. And I watched that happen. Now, at the time, I'm in a contract with Compass until close to the end of 2023. So like financially, it just didn't make sense for me to leave at that point. So I knew sort of at the end of my initial 2-year term with Compass that eXp was probably going to be the place. And then, you know, Compass didn't do anything valuable to sort of keep me there. And, you know, it was also fairly costly for me to make that transition. I can't go into details about it, but, you know, it was very expensive to make that transition. But I just sort of, again, like I knew that that was, that aligned with more of, you know, the future that I wanted than staying at Compass and just selling real estate in perpetuity would.
Yeah. And you watch someone do it all, risk it all, and you had a firsthand view of it and introspectively.
And I think that I'm probably more risk tolerant than most with decisions. And if you look at sort of the trajectory of my career, I think you can probably see that. Mm-hmm. Like I just sort of like inherently, I understand. I don't think it's a conscious thing where I know that I'm going to do it. I just, maybe it's an aloofness or like a, I don't know how to describe it, but maybe there's a certain inherent confidence that I know that I'll figure it out.
Your mom had that.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, she has that, and it's been interesting to better understand like who I am and like why I tick and sort of look inward and determine like what my beliefs are and what I have faith in and what sort of matters and what doesn't and what I've conditioned myself to feel like matters when it really doesn't and what matters and I ignore. And so I started to just, and this was not an easy process. Like if you ask Aaron, like I am very coachable, but I'm also like, I feel like I have to understand things fully. And so it was just him sort of giving me information and helping me and guiding me. And then sort of eventually I was able to see it. You know, I had a vision of what eXp was. I had made a mental decision that eXp is not for me because primarily in this area.
I'm so interested.
Because I think when eXp first sort of came on the scene, I think that the perception of it was that it was a multi-level marketing, like a pyramid scheme, right? And the reason for that is because in all honesty, there was a lot of people that were treating it that way, you know, like, hey, listen.
At first glance, it seems that way.
Yeah. Well, that's because if I am really interested in that and I can attract real estate agents to this platform and then they go out and attract real estate agents to this platform, it can very much function like that.
Yes.
That was not something that I was interested in. And I knew a couple of people in this, you know, in the New England area that were like that. And that was very off-putting to me.
Yep.
What I very quickly realized is that yes, it can be abused like that, but that is never a sustainable way to grow an organization like eXp or an organization like we have here at eXp now, because eventually the people that you attract to the company need advice and guidance. They need an organization that actually provides a lot of value to them to help them because this business is not easy.
And if eXp doesn't actually invest in all the agents they're pulling in, then you just have numbers and overhead costs and
But we don't at eXp. That's the beauty of eXp because we're 100% virtual office. We have no physical office space and we have very little recruiting and management compared to the size of the company, right? And so their overhead was very, very low. So they can have massive amounts of agents that are non-productive, but they don't want that either. So what I came to understand was that this was an opportunity. If you if you as an individual agent chose to go in this direction to provide value to other real estate agents, and in turn, their partnership would fuel, you know, your income, mm-hmm. you can have this exchange of value. They're going to produce real estate that's going to, in part, help you receive money, and you're going to help them either, you know, increase their business, evaluate what they want out of life, help them grow a downline, all of that kind of stuff. So
it's modeled from the top down. So it's modeled that way, and then it filters. So you're getting people coaching you and putting time into you, and your results are benefiting them. And because you see this exchange happening above you, you're also replicating it below you. Yep. And then it just continues.
And then those people that have partnered with me get proximity and access to everybody that I'm getting value from.
Right.
And so it's this overwhelming value exchange that the person that you're attracting to the company, like agents that are in my downline, are getting exponentially more value for the dollar that they're giving out to me. Like I get way less compensation than the value I believe that I'm giving. And that's what I would prefer.
Or that you're receiving too from above you.
Correct.
And I feel like as an agent out there, a lot of times you're on your own. Like if you bring in the numbers, great. And we'll house you. But like it's up to you. But here it sounds like what you found at eXp was people wanting you to do really well with not and caring.
So I think that the beauty of eXp is that it is a platform to process transactions and allowing, you know, real estate agents to participate in the equity growth of the company overall. So it's an experiment in distributed leadership. So instead of having this hierarchical structure, which most real estate companies are, where all the agents are making all the money, and then the kings and the queens, a very few number of them are benefiting right. at the top, right? That's a hierarchical model of business, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, what they're saying is, okay, well, we are creating the platform to process transactions, and then there's all of you guys that are providing value and attracting agents. And if you do that, we're going to share 50% of our revenue. We're going to share that with all of you guys. And there's no limit to who, or there's no chosen ones that are going to benefit more than other. It's exactly what you put in is going to be what you get out. And so I just looked at that model and it was really, really attractive from the standpoint of being able to provide value to agents who will then be able to go out and create, you know, this stream of revenue that will outlast their real estate production. So the biggest trap in real estate is that you can make a lot of money, but then you reward yourself for all of the hard work yes. and you increase your lifestyle. And then you very rarely see people actually adequately save for retirement. And so that's why you see
assume they can make it again the next year.
Right. And that's why you see a lot of 60, 70, 80 year old real estate agents still hacking away because they still need the money. And there's no like pension program in real estate, and there's no structured 401k system right. at real estate. So, you know, you're just making, you're making all the money, and then
you're
typically
managing.
People are making almost to a T exactly what they need to survive. Like if they have to make $150,000 to pay their bills and survive in real estate, then they're going to make that. And very rarely do they make in excess where they can invest and do all that
stuff. Make it in excess and then not spend it and set it up, set their like new level of living up.
Yep.
You were thinking long term when you made the switch to eXp.
Correct.
Because they set you up with an exit strategy, almost.
Yeah. And I think that for me personally, I think
as an agent,
I think that opportunity is available for anybody that partners at eXp. What I think was impactful for me personally was that I finally sort of started connecting to the dots to the reason that I was sort of feeling sort of unsettled and not satisfied with my life at that point is because it wasn't really in alignment with what I wanted to do. I had all of this knowledge and skill set and all of this kind of stuff, and I just wasn't ever sitting back. I wasn't ever Like there was nothing, there was no value to me showing other agents and helping them succeed outside of opening my own brokerage, which is a whole nother problem in and of itself. But like, I just wasn't, I wasn't in alignment with what I wanted to do. And through a lot of work, you know, with Aaron and looking sort of introspectively and looking at what I actually wanted out of life and how I wanted to spend the second half of my adult life.
You didn't want to be at open houses on the weekends with an 11 and 8-year-old at home. Personally, that didn't align.
No, it didn't align. I just didn't want to do the same thing over and over and over again.
You saw the repetitiveness of it and the like, what you had set yourself up for.
Yeah.
And you were like, just, you know, exhausted at the thought of it.
If you're in a corporation and you work as hard as I do at a corporation, eventually you're just going to continue to move.
Coast.
Right. Well.
And eventually you will set yourself up to.
But if you work really hard at a corporation, they're going to promote you and they're going to have you do different things. That's what people do. You get in an entry level position and then you go up to this and then you go up to this and then you get an opportunity to switch over to that department because your knowledge and skill set from there, and then you can manage people and then you could just continue to go up. At real estate, it's like, well, you're going to do, I want twice as much results, so I'm going to work twice as hard. I'm going to make twice the amount of money, but like, it's not a whole lot different. Right. There's not a whole lot.
Especially as you head into your 40s, 50s, 60s, and you've even said it's 70s. Like to envision that is.
It was a scary thought to be doing the same thing 20 years from now as it is right now. But the difficulty in real estate is that because we can make so much money.
Yes.
It's really hard to go, I have worked 20 years to get to a point where I'm making a lot of money and have success and sort of have the creature comforts and can invest money and all that kind of stuff. It's really hard to then make a conscious decision to pivot away from that.
Yeah.
And like give that up. Okay. Yeah. So you're making, you know, $500,000 in net to you income after all expenses. And you invest a couple hundred thousand and you're going to walk away from that versus doing that for another 10 years. And so it's a, letting go of what I found is that letting go of things is way harder than just diving into something new. Mm-hmm. Like diving into something new is very easy, but letting go of something is really, really hard.
I feel that. Even from like getting back into the workplace with my daughters now, like in school full time, it was really hard to let go of what I had created and the routine I had created, mm-hmm. even though I knew I wanted to be out there. So what do you see for yourself in the next 5, 10, 15 years? Where are you headed?
So I
think, what are you open to?
I think that I've defined my goal as doing meaningful work with people that I like and enjoy. And I don't want to oversimplify that, but I don't know what that's going to look like in 10 years. I can tell you pretty clearly what it's going to look like over the next couple of years as I grow and, you know, develop into a better leader and a better speaker and a better and more articulate person. I can tell you sort of what that looks like, but 5 or 10 years, I have no idea. But the bottom line is that I want to do meaningful work with people that I like and enjoy. And I'd like to be financially free and independent so that if I don't want to do things because I have to do them for money, I want to do things because it aligns with the person that I am and the impact that I want to have. And that's what I found over the years is that, and we talked a little bit about it yesterday when we were shooting that content for like hardworking and hustling people. Mm-hmm. But I found that sort of everybody that I've met that is financially free and independent, right? They wake up and they don't worry about paying bills to support their lifestyle. It's not that they're not trying to make more money, but they don't have to. Every single person that I've met or had the opportunity to meet in that situation, they start to revert back to like the meaning comes from the impact that they can have on others.
And it's all at different levels too. What the number is based on the person.
Yeah.
So it's not like once you make it to this one number, you're going to feel that. It's all personal development and like really being reflective of what you want and what really makes you happy. And maybe it's very, very little that you need. Most, your number's small.
Most people that haven't outsized their lifestyles like I have, because I have a larger lifestyle than perhaps in hindsight I would have created knowing what I know now. Most people, if they have $10,000 worth of residual income, you can go a lot of places in this country and live off of 10 grand a month, right? If you have zero debt, right? And you have $10,000 a month coming in residually, you can live pretty much anywhere you want. You know, you're not going to live in downtown Boston or, you know, any major metropolitan area, but on the outskirts of like anywhere, you can survive on that. And so I think defining that for each individual person is really important, and understanding that when you become financially free and independent, you can make decisions independent of the money that you're making. Mm-hmm. So if it doesn't align with what you want to be doing, you can just literally let it go. Mm-hmm. And to have that is freedom. Freedom is not having enough money to do whatever you want to do, but you still have to show back up to a thing that you hate doing.
Yes.
That's not freedom. That's a prison in and of it. That's a really nice prison, but it's still a prison.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be imprisoned anymore. And I don't believe that the impact that I can have will be as valuable if I am imprisoned. I think I need to get to a point where I can show the freedom that is a result from intentional and meaningful work. And I believe that if I can do that, I can create other leaders, and the impact can be exponential. And I learned that from Aaron. Aaron is, I am a you know, not to get biblical, but like I am a descendant of that impact that he's having on people. And I intend to have that impact on other people. And
show that there is a different way from the rat race, and you can still hustle and be competitive, but be free.
So we talked about it yesterday about this hustle culture. And I think one of the things that I remembered after was that, you know, hustling and outworking your opponents or outworking everybody, it's a season. That's not a business model. You can't do that in perpetuity. Mm-mm. You can't, like, the people who out-hustle everybody for 30 or 40 years, they die of a heart attack alone.
They're running from something. Yeah.
Their kids don't like them. Their wife, they've gotten divorced 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
Now, they might have like a house in Malibu. They might have a private chef. They might have all of that, right? And all of that is to give them some sort of feeling of like meaning for all of it. But, you know, again, that doesn't align with what I want to do anymore. And I want to be an illustration of what is possible. And very, very fortunately, I've run across people, and I put myself in proximity with people that are doing that sort of thing. And I also have aligned myself with a company that truly believes in that too.
Freedom.
Yep.
I love it. So freedom is what you're forecasting.
I think freedom and impact. I genuinely want to have an impact on other people. Like, I want to be able to relay what I know, not only about real estate, but what I've learned about being sort of an introvert in an extrovert industry and not being very introspective, but starting to understand that that is such a powerful thing to have introspection. And from somebody who never really put any value or credence into, you know, mental, spiritual, and emotional sort of health, I understood the concept of physical health, and I've always been very good at sort of making that a priority. But, you know, the mental side of things, the spiritual side of things, the emotional side of things, I was never really connected. And so whether you have the wonderful ability to be connected emotionally, or whether you were more like me and sort of shut off to that, I believe that that's needed as well. So there's a certain sense of, like, especially when I have conversations with people, and you know this too, you know, there's a lot of it that has to do with business, like X's and O's and that sort of thing. But there's also a lot of like mental, spiritual, and emotional components to it, because I don't believe that any of them are sort of separate. I think that it's all a collective group, and you have to be able to address both in true order health. To, yeah.
Yeah, true health and happiness. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm excited to watch and to be alongside you with it.
Yeah.
And to have that rub off on me too. Paul and I definitely, we value freedom and autonomy above all else.
Yep.
So to have that financial piece fit into.
And I think cool that's
watch and figure out.
And that's the beauty of this, is that you're not doing things solely for yourself, right? Like, I want everybody that is in proximity to me to succeed with me or past me. Like, the best thing that could happen is that everybody sort of in my ecosystem and in my environment well exceeds what I can do. Mm. And hopefully it's done with the perspective and the leadership and the guidance that I can provide that can multiply to, you know, an exponential number of people. So
we're going to watch it.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Well, thanks for sitting with me and telling me all that. It was really cool to hear where you started and what real estate was to where you are now.
Yeah.
It's been a journey.
Yeah, it's been fun and sort of being able to define it and go back and sort of look at reflect. All of the things and reflect has been a lot of fun to do that over the last couple of years as I'm doing what I'm doing. So yeah, I mean, obviously if you guys are watching this on any platform, obviously like and subscribe to whatever channel that you're listening to. If you're a real estate agent out there and you're sort of in a similar position, whether you've got a lot of experience in the business or if you're newer in the business, reach out, because again, you don't need to make any decisions right now, but I think most people just need to start getting some proximity to ideas and to opportunities that are out there. And again, just sort of listening and doing that and putting, you know, coming together and collaborating doesn't mean you need to make a decision. It just means that you're going to get some perspective. And so if you're a real estate agent out there and you'd like to learn a little bit more, certainly reach out to us. Or as a first step, just follow along and consume a lot of content. And hopefully that will help sort of get you there.
Love it.
Yeah.
All right. Bye, y'all.
See ya.